Definitely keep you posted. I'm Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. Coming up, Andrew Smith presents Ask a Teacher. We also have words and their stories from Anna Mateo. And we close the show with an American story. But first, in the winter of 1789, around the time George Washington was elected as the first United States president, a printer quietly published what would become the first American novel. William Hill Brown wrote the book called The Power of Sympathy. Isaiah Thomas and Company in Boston, Massachusetts, published it anonymously. Around 100 pages long, The Power of Sympathy is a love story of two young New Englanders. Their relationship ends suddenly and tragically when they learn of a shocking secret. The book is dedicated to the young ladies of United Columbia, the United States. Outside of Boston, though, few Americans would have known or cared about The Power of Sympathy as a historical marker. David Larimore, who teaches at the University of Idaho, has written about early U.S. literature. He said, "If you picked 10 random citizens, I doubt it would have mattered to any of them. Most people weren't thinking about the first American novel," he added. The Power of Sympathy is in many ways a sign of its time, with its use of letters, religious messages, and formal language. But the story also includes themes of the worries and hopes of a young country. Dana McLean is an assistant professor of English at Holy Family University. McLean noted that Brown was an outspoken Federalist who believed in a strong national government and stable society. The letters in The Power of Sympathy include the subjects of class, public outlook, and the differences between North and South, as if expecting the Civil War that followed in the 1860s. Like many other early American writers, Brown tied the behavior of women to the fate of the larger society. The novel's letters concern the power of pleasure and how female envy could bring a flood of scandal. The book compares high moral standards to a mighty river that fertilizes the country through which it passes. A character in the book warns, "Most of the novels with which our female libraries are overrun are built upon a foundation not always placed on strict morality and in the pursuit of objects not always probable or praiseworthy." The character adds, "They appear to me totally unfit to form the minds of women, of friends, or of wives." The Power of Sympathy was commonly cited as the first American novel in the 1800s without much debate. Experts then agreed that the honor should belong to the first book written and published in the United States by a writer born and still living in the country. These guidelines disqualified several earlier works, such as Charlotte Ramsay Lennox's The Life of Harriet Stewart and Thomas Atwood Digg's Adventures of Alonzo. Arthur Brown was likely born in 1765 in Boston. One of his early published works was a poem about Daniel Shays. Shays led a rebellion of former Revolutionary War soldiers in Massachusetts. Brown was not yet 30 when he died in North Carolina in 1793, from what experts believe was malaria. He never married or had children. After his death, publishers released his play, The Treason of Arnold, and another novel, Ira and Isabella. Brown did not gain much fame in his short life. No memorials, historical places, or literary societies have been named after Brown. Even the site of his burial place is a mystery.
Hello. This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Honora in China about the usage of three similar words. Dear teacher, I am confused by the three words zest, drive, and desire. I sincerely hope to know their differences. Thank you for writing to us, Honora. I'm happy to answer this question. While drive and desire can be verbs, in today's lesson, we look at their use as nouns. Zest is also a noun. The words zest, drive, and desire can each describe a state of having strong or positive energy. The three words differ mostly by the words we connect to them. We usually put the preposition for directly after the word zest. For example, we can say,
she has a zest for life.
With the nouns drive and desire, we put the preposition to after them, as in these examples.
He really has a drive to succeed. She has a desire to do good.
Try to memorize words and their prepositions as a unit, such as a zest for and a drive to. That will help you improve how you use your vocabulary. Zest is a non-count noun, so we cannot put the determiner many before it. Instead, we can say, so much zest, a lot of zest, or full of zest. We also say we can do something with zest. Drive is also a non-count noun. As with zest, we cannot use the determiner many before it. Filled with are words we put before desire, as in this example.
From a young age, he was filled with a desire to travel the world.
Zest and drive can differ slightly in meaning. Zest generally means having a lot of energy and enjoyment connected to activities you do. For example, you can have a lot of zest for playing a sport or for the work you do. But drive is more often used to describe a strong desire to reach a goal. knowing details about the words we commonly use with the nouns we have been talking about can help you use them correctly. And when you read and listen to English, pay attention to words that are commonly grouped together. We hope this explanation helps you, Anora. We hope you have a zest for learning new things about English. Do you have a question about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Andrew Smith.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore words and expressions in the English language. We hope it gives you something to think about. In other words, we hope this show gives you some food for thought. Food for thought is a set noun phrase. It describes something that should be thought about and considered carefully. The food can come from many different sources. A news story, an idea, an offer, an opinion, or advice can all give us food for thought, just to name a few. When you give someone food for thought, you make them consider carefully or think seriously about something. Food for thought can also make us see things in a new way. It can make us look at something with new eyes. Or we can say it opens our eyes or is eye-opening. Now let's hear two friends use some of these expressions.
I read a story the other day about beekeeping. It was eye-opening. Did you know that some people use it as a way to reduce stress?
Really, I know it helps the environment, but I did not know that it also helps the beekeeper.
The story really opened my eyes to the possibility of beekeeping, so I've decided to start this summer. Do you want to help?
No, thanks. I'm afraid of bee stings. But you've given me food for thought. Working to help the environment and reduce stress sounds like an interesting idea. Maybe I can find another way.
I'm sure you can.
Food for thought is meant to be processed or digested just like, well, food. In fact, we sometimes use the word digest when talking about thoughts and ideas. Here's an example. The writer's conference gave her much food for thought. It took her weeks to digest everything she learned. Food for thought can be used in formal and informal situations. There is a food-related phrasal verb that is similar to food for thought, although it is much more informal, to chew on something. Like eating food, when you chew on something, you think about it thoroughly. Here's an example. When my friend was offered a job, he chewed on the offer for some time. In the end, he decided that the job was not for him and did not accept it. If you want to sound more formal, you can use verbs like reflect or contemplate. Food for thought often leads to reflection and contemplation. And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. Recently, what has given you food for thought? Let us know in the comments section or send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
And now, the program American Stories. Today, we hear The Caliph, Cupid, and the Clock by O. Henry.
Prince Michael of Valleluna sat in the park on the seat he liked best. In the coolness of the night, he felt full of life. The other seats were not filled. Cool weather sends most people home. The moon was rising over the houses on the east side of the park. Children laughed and played. Music came softly from one of the nearer streets. Around the little park, cabs rolled by. The trains that traveled high above the street rushed past. These cabs and trains, with their wild noises, seemed like animals outside the park, but they could not enter. The park was safe and quiet. And above the trees was the great round shining face of a lighted clock in a tall old building. Prince Michael's shoes were old and broken. No shoemaker could ever make them like new again. His clothes were very torn. The hair of his face had been growing for 2 weeks. It was all colors, gray and brown and red and green-yellow. His hat was older and more torn than his shoes and his other clothes. Prince Michael sat on the seat he liked best, and he smiled. It was a happy thought to him that he had enough money to buy every house he could see near the park if he wished. He had as much gold as any rich man in this proud city of New York. He had as many jewels and houses and land. He could have sat at table with kings and queens. All the best things in the world could be his. Art, pleasure, beautiful women, honor. All the sweeter things in life were waiting for Prince Michael of Valleluna, whenever he might choose to take them. But instead, he was choosing to sit in torn clothes on a seat in a park. For he had tasted the fruit of the tree of life. He had not liked the taste. Here in this park, he felt near to the beating heart of the world. He hoped it would help him to forget that taste. These thoughts moved like a dream through the mind of Prince Michael. There was a smile across his face with its many-colored hair. Sitting like this in torn clothes, he loved to study other men. He loved to do good things for others. Giving was more pleasant to him than owning all his riches. It was his chief pleasure to help people who were in trouble. He liked to give to people who needed help. He liked to surprise them with princely gifts. But he always gave wisely, after careful thought. And now, as he looked at the shining face of the great clock, his smile changed. The prince always thought big thoughts. When he thought of time, he always felt a touch of sadness. Time controlled the world. People had to do what time commanded. Their comings and goings were always controlled by a clock. They were always in a hurry and always afraid because of time. It made him sad. After a little while, a young man in evening clothes came and sat upon a seat near the prince. For half an hour he sat there, nervously. Then he began to watch the face of the lighted clock above the trees. The prince could see that the young man had a trouble. He could also see that, somehow, the clock was part of the trouble. The prince rose and went to the young man's seat. "I am a stranger, and I shouldn't speak to you," he said. "But I can see that you are troubled. I am Prince Michael of Valyaluna. I do not want people to know who I am. That is why I wear these torn clothes. It is a small pleasure of mine to help those who need help. First, I must feel sure they are worth helping. I think you are. And perhaps your trouble may be ended if you and I together decide what to do about it. The young man looked up brightly at the prince, brightly, but he was still troubled. He laughed then, but still the look of trouble remained. But he accepted this chance to talk to someone. "I'm glad to meet you, prince," he said pleasantly. "Yes, I can see you don't want to be known. That's easy to see. Thanks for your offer to help, but I don't see what you can do. It's my own problem, but thanks." Prince Michael sat down at the young man's side. People often said no to him, but they always said it pleasantly. "Clocks," said the prince, "are tied to the feet of all men and women. I have seen you watching that clock. That face commands us to act, whether or not we wish to act. Let me tell you not to trust the numbers on that face. They will destroy you if they can. Stop looking at that clock. What does it know about living men and women?" "I usually don't look at that clock," said the young man. "I carry a watch, except when I wear evening clothes. I know men and women as I know the trees and the flowers," said the prince warmly and proudly. "I have studied many years, and I am very rich. There are few troubles that I cannot help. I have read what is in your face. I have found honor and goodness there, and trouble. Please accept my help. I can see that you are wise. Show how wise you are. Do not judge me by my torn clothes. I am sure I can help you." The young man looked at the clock again, and his face grew darker. Then he looked at a house beside the park. Lights could be seen in many rooms. 10 minutes before nine, said the young man. He raised his hands and then let them fall as if hope had gone. He stood up and took a quick step or two away. "Remain," commanded Prince Michael. His voice was so powerful that the young man turned quickly. He laughed a little. "I'll wait 10 minutes and then I'll go," he said in a low voice, as if only to himself. Then to the prince he said, "I'll join you. We'll destroy all the clocks, and women too." "Sit down," said the prince softly. "I do not accept that. I do not include women. Women are enemies of clocks. They are born that way. Therefore, they are friends of those who wish to destroy clocks. If you can trust me, tell me your story." The young man sat down again and laughed loudly. "Prince, I will," he said. He did not believe that Prince Michael was really a prince. His manner of speaking proved that. "You see that house, Prince? That house with lights and 3 windows on the 3rd floor? At 6 tonight, I was in that house with the young lady I'm going to... was going to marry. I'd been doing wrong, my dear Prince, and she heard about it. I was sorry. I wanted her to forget it. We're always asking women to forget things like that, aren't we, Prince? 'I want time to think,' she said. 'I will either forget it forever or never see your face again.' At 8:30, she said, 'Watch the middle window on the 3rd floor of this house. If I decide to forget, I will hang out a long white cloth. You will know then that everything is as it was before, and you may come to me. If you see nothing hanging from the window, you will know that everything between us is finished forever. That, said the young man, is why I've been watching that clock. The time was past 23 minutes ago. Do you see why I'm a little troubled, my torn prince? Let me tell you again, said Prince Michael in his soft voice, that women are the born enemies of clocks. Clocks are bad. Women are good. The white cloth may yet appear. Never, said the young man hopelessly. You don't know Marion. She is always on time to the minute. That was the first thing I liked about her. At 8:31, I should have known that everything was finished. I'm going to go west. I'll get on the train tonight. I'll find some way to forget her. Good night, Prince. Prince Michael smiled his gentle, understanding smile. He caught the other's arm. The bright light in the prince's eyes was softening. It was dreamlike, clouded. Wait, he said, till the clock tells the hour. I have riches and power, and I'm wiser than most men. But when I hear the clock tell the hour, I'm afraid. Stay with me till then. This woman shall be yours. You have the promise of the Prince of Valleluna. On the day you are married, I will give you $100,000 and a great house beside the Hudson River. But there must be no clocks in that house. Do you agree to that? Sure, said the young man. I don't like clocks. He looked again at the clock above the trees. It was 3 minutes before 9. I think, said Prince Michael, that I will sleep a little. It has been a long day. He lay down on the seat, as if he had often done it before. You'll find me on this park on any evening when the weather is good, said the prince. Come to me when you know the day you'll be married. I'll give you the money. Thanks, prince, said the young man. That day isn't going to come, but thanks. Prince Michael fell into a deep sleep. His hat rolled on the ground. The young man lifted it, placed it over the prince's face, and moved one of the prince's legs into an easier position. Poor fellow, he said. He pulled the torn coat together over the prince's body. It was 9. Loud and surprising came the voice of the clock, telling the hour. The young man took a deep breath and turned for one more look at the house. And he gave a shout of joy. From the middle window on the third floor, a snow-white, wonderful cloth was hanging. Through the park, a man came, hurrying home. Will you tell me the time, please? Asked the young man. The other man took out his watch. 8:29, and then he looked up at the clock. But that clock is wrong, the man said. The first time in 10 years, my watch is always... But he was talking to no one. He turned and saw the young man running toward the house with 3 lighted windows on the third floor. And in the morning, 2 cops walked through the park. There was only 1 person to be seen, a man asleep on a long park seat. They stopped to look at him. "Ish Michael a dreamer," said one. "He's been sleeping like this in the park for 20 years. He won't live much longer, I guess." The other cop looked at something in the sleeper's hand.
"Look at this," he said. $50. I wish I could have a dream like that."
And then they gave Prince Michael of Valleluna a hard shake and brought him out of his dreams and into real life.
That's all the time we have for today's show, but join us again tomorrow for another VOA Learning English program. Thanks for listening. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Brian Lynn.